All right, welcome back to episode 13 of the Sideline Sessions podcast with Wesley Sykes. I'm, of course, Wesley Sykes, the managing editor of Coach and Athletic Director, Training and Conditioning, and Winning Hoops Brands for Great American Media Services. And you can listen to all of our previous episodes anywhere you can access podcasts, as well as any of our websites, coachad.com, training-conditioning.com, and winninghoops.com. And be sure to follow our brands on Twitter, at coach_AD, at traincondition, and at winninghoops, as well as myself, if you'd like, at wesleysykes_. And today, we welcome to the program Matt Feld, who's a freelance journalist for the Boston Herald and many other outlets, to discuss the recent story regarding the Duxbury football team using anti-Semitic play calls during the game, during this fall 2 MIAA season. So, Matt, thank you for taking the time to chat with us here today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, great. Yeah, and I'm happy to have you here. Of course, the Boston Herald, for anyone who might not be in the Massachusetts or New England area, right, is really one of the preeminent newspapers in the region. But I think specifically in regards to the high school sports, just aside from the news and their back page with their sports, I think specifically their high school sports department does a fantastic job, maybe one of the best, in the state, if not definitely eastern part of the state. So, I think the Boston Herald has done a great job of kind of leading the forefront and kind of being on the forefront of this story. So just to get everyone up to speed, or fill everyone in, what happened with this Duxbury football team and where do we currently stand?
Yeah, I mean, really quite a story. So the Duxbury, it became apparent that Duxbury head coach Dave Mamaron did not coach against Silver Lake in their week 2 game. I believe that was on March 19th. Due to a one-game suspension, as the school had begun an investigation that the team was using anti-Semitic line adjustments at the line of scrimmage. As a result of that, like I said, an investigation took place. I did some digging and discovered that on the first week of the season in the game against Plymouth North, the team had used Auschwitz as an audible at the line of scrimmage. Both administrators and people from inside the program on both sides confirmed that from that game. The more digging I did as that week transpired, the week following Mamaron's suspension, the more I found that this went back numerous years, at least 2, if not 3. It included incidents at the JV level as well. So it was program-wide. It was a culture that had been built into the program. In other words, came about that have been reported. It became apparent of how this all started. Originally, rabbits was the term to go right at the line of scrimmage. That turned to rabbi, which turned into other phrases associated to Judaism to a point where the terms became anti-Semitic. It included Auschwitz, Hitler, other unflavorful, hurtful, and insulting on top of discriminatory audible line calls as well. So since that point, Dave Mamaron's been relieved of his duties as Duxbury head football coach. The team has did cancel their games last Friday against Hingham. In terms of whether or not the team will play the rest of the season, that's up in the air. My personal feeling is that may be unlikely, but it's certainly not set in stone. But the big thing being there is that all coaches right now are being investigated to see what they knew, when they knew it, how long it's been going on for, is it program-wide? And from an administrator standpoint, there's no evidence that I've found to this point that administrators knew that this was going on. Now, that could certainly be a bigger problem. I mean, how do you not know this is going on? Right. But there's some interesting dynamics going on at that school that as a result, the football program had kind of superseded anything else that goes on in the town. And when that happens, sometimes you kind of run into difficult circumstances where they're kind of allowed to get away with some things for an extended period of time. And in this case, that proved to be detrimental to the community and the high school.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the football team maybe rising to a certain status within the town. I mean, just to go over, Dave Mamaron's numbers, he's been the head coach since 2005, right, going 149-32 with 5 Super Bowls and 6 appearances, or if I'm looking over my research correctly, he was in the Division III state title game last year and losing, and then last winning in 2016. So this is a team, that has featured, a large amount of success in the, what I would say, 15, 16 years that he's been, at the helm of this organization.
Yeah, he's won 5 Super Bowls, I think, going back to 2005. He's had a tremendous career. He is one of the best coaches from a football standpoint, without doubt, in New England. And you really can't top his resume with the teams he's been. They scrimmage always the best teams in the state, if not in the region. By far, the talent that's come out of that program is second to none. College players up and down the line is incredibly impressive. But at the end of the day, you're still a high school football coach. And your main job as a high school football coach is to develop your players, not just as football players, but personally as well, from a character evaluation standpoint. And so, you know, when that gets lost and you lose kind of who you are as an educator, which at the end of the day is what those jobs are supposed to be, where you're instilling values in your kids that you want them to take on at the next level, whether it's in college, whether it's playing, not playing, or in the workforce, when you lose your ability to do that and instead are leading them down a different path, how good you are as a coach no longer matters.
Yeah, you know, and I apologize for my dog making a special guest appearance. I think it must be the time of the mailman there. So professional as always, right? Just playing right on through it, Matt. So I appreciate that. And something I wanted to kind of circle back to, you mentioned, you know, at the play calls for the offensive line, kind of starting out as rabbit and then as a left and right for kind of maybe where the pressure is going or where the play was going to be going. We see that sort of thing often, right, with football teams, whether they use, you know, R and L verbiage to go left or right. And from what I've heard, I believe I heard this on the radio station WEEI, Lou Merlone, one of the hosts there, I believe was talking to someone, or at least he was saying that, who was at close ties to the organization. And it eventually developed out of, you know, from that R and L verbiage to something that was related to, you know, Judaism and that religion, to throw people off so people wouldn't know, all right, any R word is going to the right, any L word is going to the left. Is that confirmed, or do you know any truth behind that at all?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. At some point, there was concern that the opposing team had figured out what each of the calls meant from a right and left standpoint. So as a result, those calls then devolved to still so the team knew which direction they were blocking, but so that the opposing team was confused. Now, look, I'm not going to add any personal commentary here because I've tried to avoid that throughout. But the fact is that there are many other words in the English language that start with R and L that you can pick from. And I don't understand the relation or the ties of the words that they chose. But the facts are the facts, and that's all we can go off.
Yeah, and I believe, now again, I could be mistaken, but if I remember that same conversation that the radio show host Lou Merlone was discussing, is that apparently there was a Jewish center who, you know, changed the term from rabbit to rabbi almost as a little bit of a joke thing. And then, you know, things can kind of spiral. It seems harmless enough at that point. And then it seems like there was a spiral out of control over something after, you know, this player may have moved on from the program.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly what took place. I think more likely than not, you know, at some point, you know, the real thing that we don't know about here is whether this was player oriented or whether this was coach initiated. Mm-hmm. We don't know, you know, and we hope, you know, hopefully the investigation reveals that. I'm not going to speculate because the truth is I truly do not know one way or the other. So I'm not going to speculate where it first originated, where it first came from. There's almost no question whether the coaches knew about it based on the facts that we have. They knew that it was taking place. I've also spoken to numerous coaches throughout the Bay State and throughout, you know, throughout Massachusetts, but also a couple that I know in other states. And I've simply asked, you know, if this was taking place and you were the opposing coach, would you hear it? And they said, absolutely. They hear everything that goes on at the line of scrimmage. Mm-hmm. And again, we have to be careful. These are not coming from the quarterback's mouth. I want to make sure that's evident, is that these are not audibles. This is not Peyton Manning calling Omaha. These are line adjustments being called by the lineman on which direction to block. Now, the quarterback hears it, the receivers hear it. All right. But the question is, how many people did hear it and allow it to keep happening? Because to me, that's the real story here, is how many people, whether within the Duxbury administration or in opposing programs, knew something was going on, particularly teams that they repeatedly played, and elected to go nowhere with it.
Yeah, and I think those are all great points. And I just wonder maybe with the lack of fan attendance and the lack of spectators around and a band and a cheerleading and all the kind of other bells and whistles that go into a high school football game, much like we maybe saw with the NBA bubble situations when the NBA playoffs were going on, you know, how much of those in-game conversations get caught on mics or, you know, just reverberate, you know, off the field and into the stands for the people who may be in attendance. You know, I imagine that might play a bigger role into, you know, how perked up people's ears are to certain things.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, though, if it's been going on for numerous years, absolutely. Now you're right. Yeah. No, it's true, right? I mean, this year you can hear a lot more. There's no question about it. You can hear everything that's going on. But when you go back and look a couple of years ago, there had been complaints that had come forward from players at lower levels that have resurfaced more now. So it'll be interesting to see exactly what comes out of this investigation that I think is going to take a couple of weeks, if not months, to fully finalize.
Yeah. And just kind of going back to that idea where, you hear so many things and having to confirm, so many different stories when a local story like this goes national. And I just find it very, very interesting because I thought the job, again, the collective teamwork from the Herald staff there, whether it was yourself or, you know, longtime sports editor there, Danny V, I thought you guys did a really good job of kind of getting the full story and really fleshing it out. And it's kind of always that juggle between being first and being right. But I think you guys might have got both there in that case. But, you know, when you do get kind of flushed in with all these tips, you know, I'm sure you talk to many people, you're on the scene and so many other people, you know, in that newsroom or plugged in. You know, how do you kind of discern what is credible, you know, what you think is following up on and then what you maybe just completely flat out disregard?
It's really hard. It's really difficult because so many people are providing tips. So many people, you know, I got countless emails, you know, direct messages, but more emails because my emails are at the top of my stories with people claiming that they had information, or not actually claiming they had information, but it's maybe saying like outlining an incident that had taken place. Well, I have to follow up on that incident with other people in a program, other people at opposing schools, because otherwise then people can just fly in with information that is just totally baseless about what they might've said at the line of scrimmage 3 years ago. Well, you know, I'm going to look into it. I mean, that's my job to make sure it's credible. More often than not, a lot of them were not credible unless they came from a coach or an administrator or a player. But at the end of the day, you know, someone, you know, if I've already released a fair amount of information on a story and then someone comes forward with something that's similar, sometimes I look at it a little differently. Like, okay, now you're submitting something because, you know, everyone else is. So then I have to investigate. Then I usually look at those claims even harsher if I believe that someone's just simply piling on and not really coming with new information. So all of my information was multiple times source. I tried in multiple cases to make sure it was 3 or 4 times source. Once I went with a story that was, or once with a tip with a 2-time source, but I'm still very confident in. But stuff is not single sourced, particularly things like this. You cannot go by word of mouth, regardless of what position it comes from. There's just so many factors at play here. Making sure that the information is accurate, especially when dealing with a delicate story like this that really impacts not just one person or one program. It really impacts the culture, the cultural reputation of a whole community.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's really well put. And I think when you're kind of discerning through all these tips, right, I think especially now everyone kind of is looking for their 15 minutes and say, oh, I helped with this story and helped with that too. So I think it is kind of tough, discerning everything. And I think that 3-source confirmation is always kind of a good one that the journalism schools kind of teach. But I also think it's interesting too, because the delicacy, like you just mentioned, of this story is I think very high. And I think as, you know, high school sports reporters, or, you know, less so sports reporters in general, but particularly high school sports reporters, you know, we're just kind of telling a game or trying to tell a interesting story, like a feature story on an individual. Very rarely do we kind of get into like the nitty gritty, difficult type of stories. So with this, and I would put quotations around this, but I think in our industry, it would be considered a juicy story. You know, how do you kind of pull back from the grips and maybe that excitement that you have as a journalist to say, this is a big opportunity in front of me, but also realize that we're dealing with real people. And in this case, you know, high school students.
It's definitely a balance, depending on what the matter is. I mean, this issue was such a sensitive topic that it kind of lent itself to it. I mean, if you kind of go off and go down a tangent, start providing your own individual perspective on a story like this,
you're going to lose credibility on the seriousness of the matter that you're reporting. So you really have to understand the full scope of what the situation is. This is not about like reporting one player of the year or anything like that,
right?
Or where someone's going to college. I mean, at the end of the day, we're again talking about the reputation of an individual. We're doing about a reputation of a program, a town, and it's huge ramifications for their kind of foreseeable future as a school and as a community. So alone, when you take those things into perspective, it really makes you and forces you again to focus really on the facts and making sure that the information that you're delivering consistently is reliable. You know, there are times where sometimes the thrill of the story catches up to you, right? I mean, well, you know, if a kid goes out there and throws five touchdowns in his first game back from injury, how do you not show over emotion, like joy for the kid, even though you don't know him, because you performed well? At the end of the day, you're there to report a game story. So yeah, for sure. There's times when emotion gets in the way and you have to try to be really careful. And again, that's why you have friends and, you know, people to talk to that you can share that your overall perspective with, but they can't go into your writing. They can't influence the way that you report, because if they do, you totally lose credibility on matters of seriousness like this one here.
Let's change gears a little bit, like you said, because that matter was very serious here. Yeah, I always like to kind of lighten the mood a little bit, particularly in this podcast here. So, you know, Matt, you know, many people are listening here, so they can't really see you at home, but you look like a fairly young guy. So, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you've gone to get to this point in your career and you know, covering a pretty big story for a marquee paper.
Yeah, you know, it's been an interesting experience, to say the least. I've had the opportunity to sort of work for a bunch of different employers, to say the least. It's been a huge and massive variety. I worked for ESPN Boston. That was my first kind of journalism big out of college, out of high school. I worked for them when I was in college. I worked for Brendan Hall, who was the editor of ESPN Boston. I got the chance to work for the Cape Cod Baseball League as a beat writer for the Wareham Gateman down there for 2 years. I've worked for the Boston Herald now for Danny V, who, in my opinion, is like the king of high school sports. He's been around for 30 years and seems to know everyone, and he knows every place, and he's been to every field, and he knows all the good places to eat. no matter where you go, whether you're in Ipswich or Gloucester or Greenfield or Sandwich, it does not matter. It's incredible. And really the big thing is just the relationships I've made. You know, that's the big thing that stands out the most. You know, when I go back to 2005, so, you know, 6 years now on the beat, or seven seasons, I guess, on the beat in some respects, the amount of coaches, administrators, different types of players I've come in contact with, and able to maintain those relationships has been incredibly unique. I've been to so many state championships at Gillette or state semifinals at the TD Garden. And one of the really cool things for me, honestly, is the people that I only see like once or twice a year at those big events. I mean, there's so many other reporters, so many other coaches that I see tens, if not hundreds of times, depending on the programs over the year. Oh, you know, over the course of the year, you know, I'm going to freaking Catholic Memorial every other day, it seems like, because they're, you know, top five in football, basketball. So, you know, I see the people over there all the time. And it's the same thing for the like of St. John's Prep and Mansfield and Duxbury, you know, you know, Franklin, you know, so those schools I'm at all the time because the programs are so good. But it's the people that I only see maybe once a year, twice a year, at Gillette, the Garden, for, you know, football finals, basketball state semifinals. Maybe I'm down in Campanelli for the baseball state finals, that you see once a year and get to say hi to and kind of make that reconnection. That's what's really cool about the role that I'm in, is I'm able to meet people from so many different places. But again, whether they're administrators, coaches, alums, people who, you know, coached with the program 20 years ago, they're coming back to show their support, people that are just affiliated with the school but are interested in athletics, you know, people that are now college coaches that coached at a high school. I mean, there's so many different people that I've met that have just taken totally different, you know, career paths or ways to get to where they are. And now being able to maintain those relationships once those players are either past high school or coaches have gone to do new things or administrators have moved roles. That's what's really been special about the last 7 years or so. I mean, I've probably covered close to 1,200 games, you know, across all sports. I mean, I've done everything from football to swim meets to girls lacrosse to boys lacrosse to softball, baseball, basketball. I mean, I think the only thing I've never covered is, well, I've covered cross country. I think the only thing I've ever never covered is like a ski meet.
Oh yeah. That's tough though. You gotta go up to Western Mass to do that, right?
Yeah, you have to. Nordic skiing, I don't think I've covered. Danny B usually takes the role on the lead on wrestling, but no, it's incredible. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the different places that I've been, the coaches I've talked to, the games, you know, one day I'm going to go look at the different schools I've covered games at. I'm sure it's in the 200s or so. So no, it's been incredible the last, you know, 6-7 years. And just, you know, as I've grown older, and again, I'm 24, but I mean, in terms of how long I've been in this business, you know, kind of the stories that I look for have certainly changed. When I first started out, I was looking for the players that, you know, were scoring 20 points a game. I mean, those are great stories. You know, those are awesome, and it's great for the kids because at the end of the day, you know, we're here to highlight their accomplishments. But, you know, particularly the last year or so, I've really kind of make an effort to kind of go towards more the news side of things, still staying in sports. I'm not interested in covering, you know, how many restaurants are closed during the pandemic, but I am interested in kind of more of the news elements on the sports side of things, and in terms of, you know, whether it's been the reopening from COVID, whether it's been the modifications that we've had to implement in order to ensure that kids can play these sports safely, whether it's the, you know, the navigation to the point where we're going to have a spring state tournament. Kind of the newsier side of the high school sports world has certainly interested me a little bit more, just because it's a break from more of the everyday, you know, basketball game coverage. You know, someone scored 13 points to lead their team. It's a nice breakup, and it's a little more exhilarating knowing that you're going after information that a lot of people are seeking.
You know, and it's funny because I was just thinking as you were saying that, because I was like, you know, maybe there's less emotion involved, right? You don't have to deal with, you know, maybe someone's parent who's upset that you wrote about them or didn't write about them or something like that, you know, and it's just the news. But as I would say, you know, in this past year and from following you on Twitter, it seems like people are very passionate about the news that you provide and the updates in there. So I'm not sure if it's a completely emotionless switch for you.
It's not emotionless. And you know, sometimes you have to hit the mute button on a lot of people, and it's not to be disrespectful or anything. It's just that I'm trying to report a story and I'm sending out multiple bits of information and I'm just like piling up the notifications beyond belief. And it's really hard. I mean, the toughest thing about Twitter and reporting through Twitter is that you can obviously, of course, only report so much information, right? You get 280 characters
or whatever. Processed information, right?
Processed information. Yeah. And sometimes people can't tell if it's a report, if it's something someone said, if it's the final fact, if it's just part of the fact. And that's a real concern and something that all journalists, I think, are going to have to continue to find a way to navigate going forward, because that's something I've really noticed throughout this process. I'd cover an MIA board meeting, I'd give someone's quote that someone had said. It was just an opinion that was offered. And people thought as a result, no, that was fact.
Right.
Well, that's not fact. It's just someone's opinion. Someone said that quote that I'm providing. We haven't decided what the final vote's going to be on something like a spring state tournament. So someone could offer the opinion we shouldn't have a spring state tournament because a lot of teams will opt out, and I'll put that quote out there and everyone sees that quote and now thinks, you know, that's fact, we're not having a state tournament for those reasons. No, someone just provided that opinion. So that's the tough thing, is that because of the limited pool of information you're able to provide on a social media tweet by tweet basis in this case, it's really hard for people to understand the gravity and the full effect of each situation or each news or full effect of each situation that takes place, each information bit that gets released. I mean, football in the fall was a great example. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, I could sit down with someone and explain to them for 20 minutes why we didn't play football in the fall, and they'll understand. They'll finally get to the point where they feel comfortable that they understand. But I'm not doing that over 400 tweets. We don't have time for that. I don't have time for that. No one wants to read that. So that's the really complicated avenue that you have to navigate, where you're giving enough information where people understand the story, but at the same time being able to hold yourself back where you're not responding to everyone's, you know, reply on why we're not doing this, why we're not doing this, we're only not doing this because of this, when really they don't have all the information, they don't have all the facts. Now you want to provide them, but again, I could happily sit down with someone and I could hold a press conference with everyone here, just like anyone at the MIA could, for half an hour on why we didn't play football in the fall, and everyone will walk away, maybe not satisfied, but understanding. But again, no one has that time to do that over social media. So that's really the tough balance, is how do you give people information that's easily digestible, that's clear to understand about the facts that have taken place, while at the same time trying to limiting as much questions that people will have as possible, because it's just impossible to answer everything with the amount of limited information that we can provide.
Yeah, and limited, I think, is perfect, right? Because, like, I look at the conversations on Twitter or just anything on social media in general. It's two separate individual engagements, right? I am putting something out there to the world. And then at a later point in time, someone else is receiving that. And they're not maybe getting the whole messages, all the tweets, all of that stuff sort of thing. So it's much like podcasts where, you and I are having one conversation and the audience feels, very engaged and very intimate with us, but we have no idea of what the audience is, right? So it's a very weird form of communication.
It's incredibly odd. It's got its positives and it has its negatives. And we really have to look at, again, every time I put something out there, sometimes it doesn't look like it, but every time I put something out there, I really think or try to think about what I submit. Now, when I'm giving some sort of sarcastic take on what's going on my screen in the Oregon USC basketball game, that's totally different. I'm definitely not thinking before I hit send.
Well, and that's the other thing, right? No one could tell tone too. Especially when you're quoting and stuff like that.
You can't tell sarcasm. You can't tell tone from a quote, which is a great point. Mm-hmm. That's something that people really struggle with and struggle to understand. You really, when you write something out that you're going to put out there, whether it's something so simple as where someone going to school to play football, or whether it's, what someone said at the line of scrimmage that turned into a massive story, you really have to double check and ensure that your information is accurate. Because once you hit send, if one person screenshots that tweet, it doesn't matter if you delete it. It's out there forever. So you have to be really cognizant about the information that you're putting out in each social media post. And until Twitter gets an edit button, you have to spell proof your, double check. You have no typos as well.
Oh, I know. But I'm not even sure that's a whole different conversation, but I'm not for sure if we're ever going to get rid of the edit button, because that's the whole purpose of Twitter, right? There's a certain level of accountability for it, but I can't tell you how many times, the autocorrect changes something when you're on the football field trying to get like a touchdown score update or something like that. And it's just a nightmare. But, we talk about this all the time. I think, what do you think the value is behind covering high school sports? I think you touched on this in one of your previous answers, but maybe from your own personal standpoint, but in overall general perspective, because I think, it's very different. And I think from a personal standpoint, the route of my career after college started kind of went in the inverse pyramid way, where I was in the pros and was working down to college and then came back to Massachusetts and was in the high school game. And it was there that I felt like I really learned how to be like a great, better journalist, a stronger journalist, and just a better idea of covering sports in general was at that high school level. So it was kind of interesting. I gained a whole new value in perspective from that. But in your opinion, what is the value behind covering high school sports for you?
Yeah, there's tremendous value across the board, which I think people really take for granted. I've had people tell me that went on to do, that I used to work with that went on to do different jobs, that if they could cover high school sports, for a full-time living, they would, just because of the joy they get out of it. In terms of, there's so many different story angles to go from. And to me, the greatest gift that comes from covering high school sports is the joy that you see from student athletes when they fulfill their dreams. I mean, and again, a student athlete's dream does not necessarily mean that they're going off to play Division I football at Boston College. Right. I mean, yeah, that's some people's dream. I mean, and that's incredible. And to see them fulfill it is equally rewarding from my perspective. But some people's dream is to just get one started quarterback as a varsity player, as a senior. Mm-hmm. Some is to score 2 points in a basketball game, when they haven't played their entire careers. Other, it's to be named captain. Others, it's to play at Gillette. Others, it's to, play, in the lacrosse state finals at BU. So being able to cover and understand and get to know different student-athletes' dreams and seeing them fulfill them, and then being able to write about them is awesome, because what they're going to remember and what they're putting up on the, of course, stereotypical, the fridge, but what they're putting in the scrapbook or what they're printing out and leaving on their desk is the article that you wrote about them. And that, to me, is what's most incredible and most memorable. Yeah, they're going to remember winning the state championship, but then they're going to take – they were on the cover of the Boston Herald and it's the picture of them in the mosh pit with the accompanying story that you wrote, and they're going to keep that forever. That to me is awesome. And there's nothing that can replace that. It doesn't matter how much you get paid outside of when it comes time to pay rent. It doesn't matter how much you get paid. In terms of the joy And the ups and downs. I mean, there's, you know, the most memorable moments, you know, include success and they also include failure.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I wouldn't call it failure, I'd call it heartbreak for other student athletes as well. So to me, that's the real reward. To me, high school athletics is so pure, it's so raw, it's so authentic.
Yeah.
These kids are simply out there doing whatever they can do on behalf of their community, their town, their friends to accomplish their goals. And right. to me, yeah. it does not get more natural and a more emotionally charged than that. And look, college athletes are going out there and they're playing their tails off as well. Most of them, though, are playing because they're trying to get to the next level,
mm-hmm.
right? Especially when you're watching it and tuning into the NCAA tournament, they're trying to get paid, play at the next level. That's awesome. All the power to them. Others, though, are going to be in a position to go off and earn well-paying jobs. You know, they have a good reputation from playing college athletics. At the high school level, it's literally about simply playing for the most part for your teammates, for mm-hmm. your coaches, for your families. And that's where, to me, the biggest reward is. It's just being able to see that firsthand, being able to see that, you know, radiated from one person achieving their individual goals to others. That's why we do what we do. That's why, you know, I'm so grateful to get the chance to work for Danny, to see those experiences firsthand. One of the first games they ever covered, I saw an eighth grader, Matt Ross, put a layup in at the buzzer to give St. Mary's the Division III state semifinal win, or D3 or D4 boys. I forget what division St. Mary's is at the time to go to the state championship. Matt Cross is now a Division I basketball player at Louisville, you know, 6-7 years later, and is one of the best players in the ACC, one of the best three-point shooters in the country. You know, I saw Kellen Grady, you know, win a state championship for Catholic Memorial in 2015 as a junior. He went on to be a terrific player in Northfield Mount Hermon. He's one of the best players in the country at A-10 and at Davidson, and now is going to go transfer and probably be part of a terrific program, whether it be Kentucky or Duke or, mm-hmm. you know, Boston, you know, Syracuse or Miami, wherever he can find a new home in the grad transfer portal. So, I mean, those are just some examples. I mean, I can literally go down the line.
Just some, right? Yeah. But I think that is the most rewarding part is you see these kids here. And I'm thinking of the same thing, the Bryson Goodines, the Noah Fernandezes of the world that you spend time with and you see their growth at a young age and then to see them on the large scale of, you know, Big East tournament or, you know, A-10 tournament, whatever the case is, and performing well, doing the thing that they love. I think that's very rewarding. And in that same vein, I think, you know, this has to be the case with you, but working, you know, at a small weekly paper like I did before this current job is that you get to know everyone in the community very well. And you meet those freshmen eighth graders, and they're meek and they're don't look you in the eye and they're everything is and they don't really know how to talk to you. And then you stick with them through, you know, their sophomore, junior, senior years. And at that point, they're all, you know, grown, they're adults at that point, they're joking around with it, they know how to talk and interact. There's all this confidence that kind of grows up, and to be able to play a small role in that by highlighting their performances and being able to provide, you know, refrigerator worthy, you know, moments and memories. You know, I think that, like you said, is the most rewarding part, because I think of it too, the paper I used to work at, my wife, you know, went to the high school there as in high school, was a volleyball player. And we were just looking through her parents' house the last, you know, weekend or so. And she pulls out all these old newspaper clippings, just like you were describing, of her state title runs and, you know, athletes of the week and, you know, outside the line kind of Q&A perspectives and all this stuff, you know, and it just kind of, you know, brings you back down memory lane. And then before you know it, 45 minutes have passed and you're just looking through all these old memories that, you know, were by these people who you don't really maybe necessarily know, but, you know, played a big part in your life as that journalist for, putting down those memories in ink.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right. I mean, there's obviously more, the amount of athletes that you talk to one time, you know, whether it's after a Super Bowl win that, you know, maybe there was a, you know, a kid that wasn't a star on his team all year and all of a sudden catches two touchdowns in a Super Bowl. I've seen that happen, you know, numerous times. Or, you know, a kid who hasn't done much, who's kind of a role player off the bench, scored 12 points at the Garden to lift his team to a win. You know, that happens countless times, numerous times. And so you've got, you know, you have these unbelievable stories of student athletes for really only one time in their career, maybe making, you know, highlight plays on the field, but they're the ones now that get the chance to be the, you know, on the front cover or be the main story, you know, in a publication. And you're there again to provide those stories. I can talk about the best football players in the state for 4 hours, but that's no fun. Mm-hmm. That's so boring. I mean, I've done that before because we've all known how good they are forever. I mean, at some point the story changes and the real stories, the real reason you're out there covering games is to find the sophomore that, you know, first varsity plays a pick six, or, you know, the senior again who's making his first career start, a quarterback throws for four touchdowns. So again, it's awesome to see the superstars. I love watching them play. They're talented, and we'll get the chance to see them on TV next year or in 2 years, literally when they're playing at an ACC school or an SEC school, because of the fact that their talent and their work ethic and their commitment has rewarded them that opportunity. But for now, when we're at the high school level, yeah, we'll cover those kids and we'll write stories on them. But the real value is in the kids just below them that are simply there because this is their one chance to play the sport they love and find some success in it to in front of their, you know, their friends, their family, and their community.
Yeah, it sounds cliche, right? But for love of the game, and I think that really does come across. It's the same reason, like you mentioned, you know, the difference between the college and the pro level, and that's the difference between the high school and the college level there. All right, so we have one last segment here before we close things up and I let you go. And you've been very gracious with your time, so I appreciate this. We'll kind of fire through here. I like to do this with all my guests. It's called five questions that have nothing to do with sports. Maybe you've heard of it before. But as you might, you know, suggest, as the title suggests here, I ask a question and then you just give me your immediate response here. You know, how does that sound?
Perfect.
All right. So your most used app that is not social media or music related.
Oh, wow. That's a good question. My most used app that is not social media, Waze. I'm always on the road.
Yeah. And, okay.
Especially when it's, you know, nowadays I'm not really going to as many random high schools that I thought were random as I was 2-3 years ago, but undoubtedly Waze. Yeah. I'm always looking for a back road and I'm trying to cover a game at 4:30 on a Friday afternoon.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And avoid any major highways around that time if you're around the Boston area. Right. Okay. So I see these type of hypothetical questions all the time on Twitter and social media. I'm sure it's the case for you as well. Who would win in a battle to the death between a silverback gorilla or a grizzly bear?
Oh, I'm going to take the grizzly bear. To me, the bears are a little more mischievous. I think they're a little quiet, a little more deceptive. I think they'd have the advantage. Yeah. I think I'm going to go with the grizzly bear.
See, this is tough because I hear like grizzly bears are like, you know, the fiercest on land, you know, like they're really tough, but the silverback gorilla has thumbs, you know, like they're like kind of like man, like a super strong man.
I don't even know why they're called silverback.
I think it's because, so that's supposed to be like the alpha male. Now I'm no Jane Goodall here, so bear with me, but I believe the silverback gorillas actually have silver backs and it's to denote the alpha male of the group. The patriarch.
Interesting. Yeah. Wow. That's
that's. So I could be. I might have to get a fact checked on that. It sounds good though, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm going with the silverback gorilla. I would like to see that. Maybe that'll happen one day.
Maybe
someone will catch that on camera. If you could live on one set of a TV show, which one would it be?
Well, live on one set of a TV show.
Yeah, like in the world, like in the town of. The Office or something like that.
Interesting. I've always found it fascinating. My sister was a huge Friends fan growing up, and I always found it kind of hysterical that the show takes place in like three different sets. They have like the apartments and the coffee shop, and that's it. Like, what a great life. I mean, perfect. Sounds so simple. I mean, somehow they're all afford to live in New York City. Well,
exactly. That's my biggest thing. I want that. That's a good set right there.
Perfect. That apartment. Yeah. Awesome. You know, the apartments. In New York City, they go to the coffee shop, and then that's about it. And yet, they're somehow making enough money to you know, live in an apartment. You know, however that works, I want to figure it out, and I'm all in.
I like that. I like that a lot. There. Yeah, it's like I think Pawnee, Indiana, from Parks and Rec. That seems like a fun town. That seems like a fun one. Or what's the other Modern Family? I don't know the town name in that, but that just seems like a great like suburban town to raise a family.
Yeah. No. Perfect. I mean, I was trying to think of someone like San Diego or on the water, but I'm kind of blank at the moment.
Yeah, that has to be like California. Like, it's always sunny there. Yes. You know, like it never rains in sitcoms.
Never. I've been to San Diego. It never rains.
See, I love it. That's great. Okay. What is the top thing that you can bake or cook? Like, if you had to whip up a meal for someone, got to really impress them, what's your go-to?
Wow, that I could cook? That's tough. I like to think I can kind of make chicken parm, but that's sketchy at best.
That's my go-to. I love it. The chicken parm's great.
Chicken parm's as good as it gets, but I delivered and I think it'd be pretty good. But if I got a phone call the next day that someone didn't feel well, I wouldn't be totally surprised.
Okay.
I do cook a fair amount, but I'm not overly extravagant. Like I can make penne with grilled chicken and broccoli. Like, but, and you know,
that's all you need.
That's all you need. And I can make peanut butter and jelly. No, I mean, no, I cook. But if you're looking for a high end meal, you're not going to my apartment. I'll tell you that much.
All right. Well, with all due time, you know, maybe we'll send you a cookbook here, and then next time we'll have you on, we can have some sort of like a Guy Fieri cook-off here. You mentioned Waze. This is actually perfect in the first question here. To wrap things up, what is your top driving pet peeve?
Ooh, wow. I have so many of them.
Yeah. I mean, we're on the road all the time, right? That's kind of how it works.
My top, I mean, people that travel below 60 miles an hour, period. I don't care if there's traffic or not, drive me insane. Like, figure it out. Just drive. Like, you got to figure it out. I mean, it comes with the territory. I mean, it's incredible. Like, I've been to so many different parts of the country. I've been in the South, the West, the Midwest. The way people drive on the road is so normal compared to Massachusetts. Like, I was borrowing my friend's car in Fayetteville, Arkansas one time, and he was in the passenger seat. I forget why I was driving, but I'd offer to drive, I guess. And I, like, hastily merged into the right lane to get onto the highway. And he was like, what are you doing? And I was like, what do you mean? Like, I sped up to get into the right lane to get on the highway. He's like, gotta slow down and let the other person pass you. I'm like, no, like, that's not the way this works here. Like, we are just such obnoxious people. We are just the worst.
He who acts last loses, right? You got to be the first to act.
I mean, I guess my biggest pet peeve in Massachusetts is the amount of like 1 and 2 lane highways we have. Like, that to me is absurd. Like,
yeah,
Route 3 is a joke. You get over the Bourne Bridge and you go, you know, I think, what is it, Orleans, where it becomes one way,
single,
you know,
one lane. Yep.
Yeah, down to Provincetown. Route 1.
That's a nightmare. That's a nightmare.
Going to Lynn, to Saugus, to Salem up there. Like, why is that one lane? Many people commute in and out of the city. So again, the problem is that if you want to expand it, then you're creating more traffic because then you have to stop the highways. It's a mess, and it's never getting fixed until we get flying cars. Driving stinks. Yeah, driving in general just stinks. It's terrible. I love driving, but driving in mass is so awful. We've been kind of helped out by the fact that less people are on the road and people are
remotely. That's not happening anymore, though. That's not happening anymore. Traffic is bad,
which means there are really only two. So here's the thing. If you're covering like a 7 o'clock game, you have two options. You can leave at 4:30 and get there exactly on time if it's 20 minutes away because it takes you 2.5 hours. Or you can leave at 1:30 and get there at 2 and find some Dunkin' Donuts to sit in for 4.5 hours. There's no winning. You're miserable either way. It's awful. And so, yeah, my over pet peeve is just, period, the roads in Massachusetts are some of the – there cannot be any worse in the world. In the world. Forget the country. In the world. There is no way there are worse roads, worse geography, and it's going up. More people are driving in mass than ever before.
They add in all those bike lanes, you know, and it's like just clogging up the car lanes.
It's insane. It's insane. More people are driving than ever before. We're going in the wrong direction when it comes to that. It's so painful. But yeah,
I agree with you on the Massachusetts road thing, just because I don't know what the deal is. I've had a car for the last 4 years. My last two cars that I've had for the last like 6 years or so, I've probably rolled over a dozen nails. I don't know where all the loose nails are in Massachusetts, but they all happen to find my car. So that's a big pet peeve of mine. And lastly, this is more, you mentioned the two lane highways and like two lane, maybe like not interstates, but like smaller roads that are two lanes. That makes sense. It's not a highway, but two lane road. I don't know. Whatever. You get the idea. Is when people are making a left hand turn, you know, across traffic into a fast food establishment that holds up the whole line, I will curse you up and down the road and then make sure I, you know, crane my head all the way when I pass you to give you a little look, because I see it all the time. I live right near a fast food gauntlet where it's a two lane highway and there's like, McDonald's, Wendy's, KFC, Taco Bell, all of these things, Burger King, all within like a half mile radius. So people are constantly making those left-hand turns across traffic and it just blocks up everything. I can't stand it.
Yeah. And now you've got the fast, you know, it's true. The fast food places that like bleed into the roads, the drive through now goes into one of the lanes of traffic for like seven cars down is just ridiculous. It's absolutely
that 7 a.m. Duncan's drive-through. That happens all the time.
All the time. All the time. Just park your car and get out. I promise you it's faster.
I agree. Well, I hope this airing of grievances just maybe made your next trip maybe a little bit less stressful on the road, but you have successfully survived 5 questions that have nothing to do with sports. So, Matt, thank you so much for taking the time out to speak to us today. Before we let you go, though, how can the people get in touch with you on social media if you would like them to do so?
Yeah, no, my direct messages are open. My Twitter is MattyFeld, 612, MattyFeld, 612. My email is somewhere on there as well. I mean, believe it or not, throughout my grievances and arrogance and sometimes sarcasm about the things that people send me, I always enjoy when people send me tips or stories, even if I end up not using them. Trust me, the more information, the better. So I'm more than happy to sift through messages to find a great story. And again, I don't write everything that I get, but the more information I get, the better. So always feel free to send me a storyline, regardless of what the sport is, regardless of what it might be. I can't guarantee I'm going to write it, and I can't guarantee that I'm going to open your message based on the first sentence that I see. But please, the more information, the better. And I always appreciate hearing from high school fans and players and coaches and community members, administrators, because they're the ones, I mean, they're the only reasons that we even have jobs. So, you know, they're the ones that tell the story. We're the ones that write it. So, you know, again, always feel and open to reach out at any point with any ideas that that you might have.
All right, pretty industrious kid, Matty Phelps. Thank you once again for taking the time with us here. And you can follow all of our brands on Twitter for those at home, at @coach_AD, at @train_condition, at @winninghoops, and then, as always, myself, if you'd like, at @WesleySykes_. And, of course, you'll be wanting to follow those accounts to get a first look at who our next guest will be for our 14th episode to be released on April 8th. Until then, sports fan, I'm Wesley Sykes, and thank you once again for listening to Sideline Sessions, and thank you, Matt.
Thanks so much for having me.